Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media Network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and a Latter-day Saint. And with me today is my co-host, Carl.
Hello, everyone. Good to be back. My name is Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion. And I have written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture.
Great. And we have two guests with us today. Our first guest is Jamie Lewis Holt. Will you introduce yourself?
Hey, it's fun to be here with you guys today talking about one of my more favorite things, which is movie and book adaptation. I have an MFA in fiction from BYU. I'm a lover of all well-written literature, fiction, nonfiction, even books of poetry. I'm an overzealous movie buff and a mother of five who I write for.
Awesome. And our other guest today is Shelby Thane. Can you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. I'm Shelby Thane. I'm an artist, an educator, a lifelong reader, and a mother of two.
Awesome. And today we are going to be talking about Where the Crawdads Sing, the 2022 film adaptation of the book of the same name. It stars Daisy Edgar Jones as a young girl living on the marshland of North Carolina, who is abandoned by her family and triumphs over her circumstances to become a naturalist and also deals with grooming and sexual assault. It is available to stream on Netflix. But first, our best book segment, where we each recommend one thing we're watching, reading, or listening to. My recommendation today is for Ted Lasso. I'm only 2 or 3 years behind, but my husband and I started watching Ted Lasso on our spring break trip, and we finished season one in only a couple of days, and we will probably keep going. It is very British comedy in its crassness. There are a lot of sexual jokes and a lot of swearing, but if you can get over that, or if you can have the filtering software get over that for you, there is a lot of just heartwarming themes to this show about the triumph of optimism and of being a good person. It's just such a fabulous show, and I know I don't need to tell half the internet about it since everybody was obsessed, but I've finally gotten to Ted Lasso, and I'm excited to recommend it to y'all. Carl, what have you got for us today?
So I know this has been recommended by other people before, but I am watching Star Trek Picard Season 3, and this is everything that I had hoped Star Trek Picard would have been in Season 1 and 2, both of which were disappointing to me in various ways. But season three is perfect so far. It's been hitting all the right notes. It's bringing the gang back together of the whole Next Generation cast. And the episode that just was released yesterday has the whole crew back together. The scene with all of them sitting around the table talking about the situation they're in and trying to figure out what they're going to do and how they're going to solve the problems they're confronted with was just such a throwback to my younger years watching Next Generation with my family. It was just wonderful. And so Star Trek Picard Season 3 is everything you would have hoped that Picard would always have been, even if it didn't live up to the expectation. My other recommendation is the third book in the Children of Time series by Adrian Tchaikovsky. It takes place in a far future where the Empire of Humanity fell. But they have to, as they rediscover their technology and are able to venture back out, they discover planets where their technology has helped formerly terrestrial animals to evolve and become sentient. The first book revolves mostly around a group of spiders who have become like a spacefaring civilization. And the second one takes place in a different solar system where a bunch of octopuses, or octopodes, became sentient and spacefaring, trying to communicate as humans with these different species that originated from our own planet. Spiders in the one case and octopi in the other. It just shows how interesting and weird science fiction get, really trying to communicate with very different creatures. And then the second book brings in an actual alien species that has not evolved on Earth. And that's fun to see the humans, the spiders, and the octopi try to deal with this fourth species. And I just picked up the third book. I know you've read it, Liz. I have not yet, but this whole series is really interesting and wonderful. And I'm recommending it. And I'm literally going to start the third book tomorrow. And I just, looking back and glancing at these, I remembered how much I liked the first two because of how do you talk to creatures that don't have mouths and don't speak in sound. It's just, anyway, it's just really interesting stuff. And I've enjoyed all of these so far and look forward to reading the third.
I gotta say, didn't like the third one as much as I loved the first two. So I'm interested to see your reactions to it, Carl. We gotta talk about it when you finish. Jamie, what have you got to share with us today?
Well, I'm currently working my way through the short story collection by Ted Chiang from the movie adaptation of Arrival, the correlation between the two, because I did enjoy the movie so much and the way in which time was used as a plot device that I wanted to read how he did it in his fiction, and finding that it was a collection of short stories made it even more interesting to me to then see it on the screen. I do enjoy his writing quite a bit. And I would recommend the short story collection for anyone. They're little short stories, 5 minutes here, 10 minutes there, that you can pick up and put back down and really think about. Something else that I noticed you guys are mentioning movies, one that I have seen recently, not based on a book that I know of, is called Slumberland. It is about a girl who is dealing with the loss of her father, and she discovers this dream world called Slumberland. And with the help of people that she meets there in Slumberland, she's able to work her way towards seeing her late father again. And it deals with such good topics of loss and grief that I loved watching with my children. I would suggest anyone who's recently gone through loss or grief or dealing with it. It's a great movie. Funny, heartfelt, one I highly suggest.
Slumberland has an interesting adaptation story because it started out as like a comic strip in the early 1900s, I believe. And then there's an 80s movie called Little Nemo, which my friend was obsessed with. And we spent a lot of our childhoods pretending we were in that movie. It's very different from Slumberland, though, except for a few characters. It's definitely an interesting thing to look at in terms of adaptation. And Shelby, what have you got for us this week?
Okay, I have been listening to The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling, which is about so much more than J.K. Rowling and her controversial tweets. It's this history of the internet and the way cultural discussion has changed through the years as a result of the internet and different communities in the internet, and how we've gotten to where we are in terms of the things we're discussing and how we're discussing them and what we're willing to hear and not hear in the current cultural moment. And I think it's fascinating and infuriating. I'm 7 episodes into the 8 episode series, and it's been quite the listen. I did want to throw out, because Carl was mentioning in the book he's reading, All the Animals, a light, but I thought a really good read is a book I read a few months ago called Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. It's a sweet story about kind of family and grief and some reconciliation and different things. Part of the story is told from the perspective of an octopus, which is why what Carl said reminded me of it. It's not like deep literature, but I enjoyed the read, and it's also got this fun twist in that you get the perspective of this story unfolding from an octopus.
Oh, that's super fun. I think that's exciting. And we will have links to all of these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and the beautiful in pop culture. We also wanted to give a shout out to a recent episode from one of our fellow Public Square Media podcasts. And the episode I wanted to recommend today is from Radical Civility, the podcast by our friend Benjamin Pacini, that talks about politics and civility with an LDS perspective. And Carl was on this episode they recently released discussing white Christian nationalism and should we be panicking? Is the church being overrun by white Christian nationalists? And how big of a problem is this? And is it a problem? And lots of interesting discussion, very nuanced. I think anyone from either side can see some value out of this discussion. So I highly recommend that episode from Radical Civility. And now we're on to our main discussion of the film Where the Crawdads Sing. This book I had seen being passed around book clubs, but I assumed it wasn't for me until I heard Jamie give a paper about it in a class I took at BYU. And then I said, well, this sounds fascinating. And so then I picked up the book and read through it this summer and just could not put it down and loved it. And then took myself to the movie without anyone else
I would have gone with you, Liz.
I should have gone with you.
This is a completely legitimate way to go see a movie, okay?
It was an artist date to myself. I deserve.
Sometimes you just gotta treat yourself.
There was not enough explosions or aliens to make my husband go, so. And that's why I assumed it wasn't for me, is because I'm usually a sci-fi fantasy nerd, and dramas and such kind of depress me. I tend to be pretty resistant to starting them, even when I enjoy them afterwards. So I was surprised by this book and really enjoyed it. Jamie, what are your thoughts on this?
I actually had a question for you, Liz. What part of me sharing Where the Crawdads Sing interests you in picking up the book? Because I was talking about the use of time and her plot device that she used in order to reveal the story and the way in which we come to the conclusion that a murderer has got off scot-free. There's my stand on it. But, or was it more that I was searching for justice? My paper that you heard about was Seeking for Restorative Justice in Fiction and Real Life. And so I'm just wondering what you thought from what I had shared. What stirred you? Because you said you're a science fiction kind of nerd, and this is not science fiction.
No, so. This is not science fiction at all. Definitely dramatic realism. Maybe Southern literature, you could call it as well. I think the thing that I found interesting about your paper was that you talked about how the novel kind of reflected the author and that she was also wanted for a similar murder that occurred while she was in Africa, I believe, wanted for questioning. And I was fascinated by that idea. And then just, yeah, the concept of justice in the novel, which I think is probably one of the main things that we're going to discuss today, is the ending just? And what does this book/film say about justice, especially for women and people who are vulnerable and sometimes don't get justice or haven't gotten justice throughout the history of the world, right? Like a lot of rapists and violent men have gotten off scot-free because women are listened to.
Yeah, this was my main sticking point in the paper that you had read, was that this book came out right on the tide of the Me Too movement, that this came out 6-7 months after the first Me Too claim. And I think people were searching for this sort of justice, this punitive justice, where someone who's had wrong done to them then is able to find that revenge. And I think that's why it did so well. I don't know if the book had been released 3 years prior, would it have gotten the same attention that it did? And so I think the timing of it, I don't think they timed it that way, but I think that's what the surge in it was, because from a craft perspective, though I loved it and the timing of it, there were things in it that as a writer, I cringed. That was considered like New York Times, 10 million copies kind of thing that's being put out there. So I do think that plays into its popularity and also the timing of it.
Shelby, did you see the film first or read the book first?
Definitely read the book first. I try really hard to always read the book first because they tend to flesh things out more. And then I will lose the experience of getting to imagine it in my head if I've seen a movie first. My family's kind of on Goodreads and we see each other's books from there. And so I had read it. It may have actually been my dad that recommended it. I think he gave it a 5-star Goodreads rating too. And so I read the book a few years ago and I just did not have time to review the whole book before now. And then I watched the movie probably shortly after it came out. I remember, like you said, Liz, I just couldn't put it down. And then I get to the end and I just go, oh, like there's just so much there in terms of that brings up like questions of, wait, did that really happen? Like, how do I feel about this? What do I do with this ending that ultimately I had like really cheered on? As the book goes on, you're hoping for that justice, right?
Carl, what's your history with the film?
Well, my history with the film is that you suggested we do it for this podcast. And so I watched it the last couple of days. But the thing is, because I'm just aware culturally of what's around in the zeitgeist, like I knew about the ending and I knew that this murder happens and that she gets away with it and then lives her life out. And I guess that means I'm the proxy stand in this conversation for our audience who now know the end of the plot. And so it was really interesting watching the movie, knowing the ending ahead of time. And I'm not one of those who thinks that we call them spoilers, But it doesn't necessarily ruin the experience of the movie or the book or the television show for me if I know the ending, because how you get there is still the better part most of the time. And I found this movie really engrossing. I really enjoyed it. I think it could have used maybe another 20 or 30 minutes or something, but, you know, that's the case with most adaptations. You got to cut stuff, and I don't fault anybody for the decisions you have to make to artistically adapt something from one medium into another. But I found the movie very compelling. I enjoyed it. My wife decided not to join me in watching it because she thought it was going to be too tense for her. That tells you how our movie watching culture is in my marriage. But I thought it was really interesting and raised some interesting questions that, as the lone male in the conversation here, I'm not sure I'm allowed to answer.
I did purposefully pick female guests, Carl, so you are not wrong. But I think there are some interesting things about the movie adaptation versus the book adaptation. I've had a hard time personally, having not lived in the South and seen what that swamp would be like, picturing that. And so I felt like the visual medium of the movie definitely helped me understand our main character's love for this swamp that she grows up in. And she literally does grow up in the swamp. Her parents and her older siblings abandon her, so she is alone from a very young age, making a living picking mussels that she can sell and live off of, just very meager circumstances. And she grows to love this marsh and the way that it's shot and just the different cool things that they show about this environment that I wouldn't typically think of as beautiful, like, really came across in this movie. And then also she becomes a naturalist who does these watercolor drawings and pencil sketches of all of the wildlife and plants. And that came across really well in the movie as well. You seeing these beautiful drawings, you can see through the character's eyes how beautiful it is.
I love that about the movie too, Liz, like how visual the marsh was, because I feel like it's like a foreign land to me. I don't know the South. I don't know marshes. I know mountains and rocks and snow. That's what I'm very familiar with. And I loved the visual storytelling, getting to see that through the movie. And I appreciated that a lot.
I did appreciate the way in which the movie gave us something to fall in love with, that I didn't feel like it was ever on a soundstage or there was a green screen or something like that. I don't feel like they cut corners in order to produce this movie, which makes it just stunning to be in those boats drifting in those tides that I read about in the book. But you're right, I don't see how tall that grass is that is around her that she's hiding in. I also felt the pacing of the movie was very well done. That even in the book, pacing is what brings the tension. But in the movie, it gives us time to watch the birds fly. That I just, cinematically, I thought it was just an A+. Just beautiful adaptation in that way.
I agree. Like, the pacing in the book is much more tense, because in the book you're alternating back and forth between the investigation of the murder and her growing up. And so you're like wondering when these two lines are going to come together. Whereas in the movie, they've made the choice to start with her being arrested. You go back and see her childhood and just like meditate in it, almost like you're sitting in jail with her and just contemplating her life.
In the book, there's a lot more to do with the investigation as well. I noticed rewatching the movie yesterday that 90% of the movie we're living in her past. And in the book, it's really almost 50-50, where we're being led through the trial and the discovery of evidence, and even how she got on and off the bus without being discovered is much more detailed in the book, which, you're right, does bring tension. But I don't fault the movie for leaving that out, because the way they rearranged it with the red hat being discovered and things like that, it did its own job of building the tension when we don't know whose it was at the end as she's throwing it back and forth with Tate. Something that's different between the book and the movie that did rub me a little raw was the discovery of the necklace, because in the movie we get it from Tate finding it in the back of a book on a very public, not behind a locked door bookshelf, that I think almost portrays the police officers in a negative light, like they weren't competent enough to look through a book to find this thing. And we don't know if it was always there or she moved it to there. But in the book, this is actually something that she stowed away under a big pile of wood. She kept the wood pile high in the kitchen next to the stove. And when they had relaid the floor, she never had floor put over that area. And so after her death and the woodpile runs low, Tate finds it, this shoebox full of poems, which is another sticking point of mine because I love poetry and they didn't throw it into the movie much. But that's where he finds this poem about the firefly, which I don't believe is even shared in the movie.
No, I think it's kind of incorporated into the artwork of the book. And so you can see it.
And she says a comment at the dinner, but literally in the poem, can I read the poem?
Mm-hmm.
It's very short. It says, "The firefly. Luring him was easy as flashing valentines, but like a lady firefly, they had a secret call to die. A final touch, unfinished, the last step, a trap. Down he falls, his eyes still holding mine, until they see another world. I saw them change, first a question, then an answer, finally an end, and love itself passing to whatever it was before it began." So beautiful in that that's what Tate reads as he finds the necklace beneath the thing. And I think at that point, the reader knows the guilt. Where in the movie, I think we're just assuming all along that she's done it.
I think there were some people who went into the movie not realizing that she was guilty. Because I think the movie tries to play off of this archetype of movies about the outsider who's wrongly accused of a crime, right? That is like a common trope for films. And so it plays off of that until the last 5 seconds. And then I heard audible gasps in the theater when I went. And that happened. They were like, people were so surprised. So I think that's an interesting choice that they've made. It's definitely not a "this is how I did it" kind of film. It's leaving you with doubt until the end. And then hitting you with the fact that she's guilty.
Even in the movie, though, they ask about the bus schedule, but they never go into the testimony of the bus driver describing the person who got on and off and her ability to morph herself into another person to save her life, the chameleon almost, which was a beautiful part of the book when you get to that part there at the end.
Yeah, for me, watching the movie, even knowing the end of the movie, I think they did a pretty good job. Like, it's not clear, like, David Strathairn does a great job playing her defense lawyer, laying out the difficulty of what she would have had to do to commit the murder as we understand it, with their alibi, with the to get on the bus, come back, murder him, get on the bus, go back, be all fresh and ready to talk to your publishers at 8 in the morning. Like, it's a complicated thing to do. So I think the movie did a pretty good job of leaving it ambiguous to the end whether she was responsible for this or not, or whether it was an accident. I don't think that, at least in my read of the movie, there was ever really a thought that he had been murdered by his rival, by Tate. But it's still at least a slight possibility. Like, where did the red hat fibers come from? But overall, they left that, I think, pretty well to the end. I think the movie wants you to think 100% that she did this thing, but I still don't know that I would convict her in a court of law of it. So I don't know. There's other tensions at play in that sort of part of the story as well.
Yeah, and so that's where we get into kind of the interesting moral question of this movie, is the question of justice. Like you just said, would you convict her in a court of law? There isn't evidence. And so the court of law would say, because there's no evidence, she is not guilty.
You're not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Exactly. And so it's interesting that it's putting us into this situation. And somehow it feels different than watching like a heist movie, right? Where you're like rooting for the bad guys to win and to get away with it. Right? It feels different somehow because it acknowledges its own moral ambiguity more than a heist novel does, or a heist movie.
Or the other movie that sprang to mind as far as your discussion, Jamie, about the good timing of releasing this into the Me Too movement. We'd like to see a woman get revenge in the cultural zeitgeist of the time. This movie also deals with the South, and I'm sure maybe some of you have seen it, Django Unchained, where we wish that we could train black slaves to be awesome gunslinging bounty hunters to walk into a plantation and just murder everybody because the slavery was so terrible. Django Unchained is total slavery revenge porn, and it's great at it, but it's completely unrealistic and doesn't deal with any of the nuance that Where the Crawdads Sing brings to the discussion of what do you do in situations like this. I kind of want to plug a book really quick. This is something I thought the movie did pretty good, is sort of gets into the idea that these men need the last hit, the sort of the Southern masculine culture. So for anybody interested in a deep dive in how, you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints intersects with toxic Southern masculinity culture, Patrick Mason's PhD dissertation, which turned into this book, The Mormon Menace, Violence and Anti-Mormonism in the Postbellum South, really gets into this, how the sort of honor culture among Southern men and Mormons are showing up to steal their wives, which meant that it was totally justifiable in their culture to just kill these guys. And just so how we see the sort of long-term repercussions of that culture in the movie itself. And I thought that was interesting and also well done. It does leave some things slightly ambiguous. I'm a little uncomfortable that she got away with it because we did some terrible stuff, but the solution to that is not the death penalty. And so there you have it.
So I found it interesting in my research for restorative justice, this work done by Ozowitz, and he said, in a cognitive account of how our understanding works, the issue of story's realism of fictionality is almost irrelevant. For our brain's cognitive circuits react to factual and fictional events in the same way. Reading fiction, not just realistic or historical, but speculative as well, affects how we interact with the world. So from a standpoint of a Latter-day Saint mother, when I talk to my children about this film, it's the storyline, the plot, the character development. But when we get to the point of we know she's guilty, how do we react to that? And how would we in life, if you find out your sister has committed the murder, what's the right thing to do? Because my children read a lot of books. I want them always to have the right versus wrong very well fleshed out. And for me, that was wrong, what she did. Even though I can see her justification in it with my brain dealing with this being fact versus fictional, it still sides as wrong. So even though reading the book, I was cheering for her, talking about it with my children, I need to have that discussion about right versus wrong in life was more valuable than how it was portrayed in this movie and book.
I love that scene that they have where Jumpin sees her black eye and is like, who did this? Aren't you going to report it? Aren't you going to do something about it? And she does such a good explanation of why so many women do not report sexual crimes, because it is humiliating. And it is difficult to think that they will be believed, especially when their attacker is someone who is well-liked and powerful in the community. And even in spite of that, she is right that, like, she would never get a conviction out of Chase. No one is going to believe her, and her reputation is going to come off worse than his. And he's going to get away scot-free and keep harassing her. Even in that case, it still feels wrong. Interesting.
I think that one thing to keep in mind is the storyline is in the later end of the 1960s, right? 1969 is when the trial's happening. So we're also in a totally different era in terms of what would happen, which I think, like you said, she says there. But as I've thought about this book and the movie this week, I keep asking the question of myself, like, what options did she have? Because did she really have no options? If she stayed there, was he going to come back again and again? Was she truly stuck in that way? Was there no one she could turn to for help? Could she have left the marsh? What would have been the better option for her than murder would have been to leave the marsh. Is there tragedy in that? Absolutely. Like, it was her home. The book sets it up as the marsh was her mother. Like, her parents abandon her and she becomes tutored by the marsh. And that's part of, like, why the marsh doesn't view death as necessarily a tragedy, right? Like, you have these examples of female insects eating their mates and things like that. And the storyline of survival is so strong. What would Kaya have been without the marsh? I don't know. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that. What could she have done besides murder him?
Yeah, it's really tough. And it's especially set up with her mother. Her mother leaves her when her father becomes abusive and hits her. And her mother walks out the next day and leaves the marsh and doesn't come back. And it's pretty clear from when her brother comes back and explains what happened to her mother. She was in shock. She was in that flight mode where she could not respond in a responsible way to care for her family. And that was one moment that I really liked in the book that I felt could have been expanded in the movie, is like her reconciliation to what her mother did to her. Because this whole time she's had this anxiety about people leaving because her mother left and never came back, just walked out, and she never got anything from her. And that's pretty traumatizing when you're a young girl.
Well, and then her dad burns the letter from the mother. There's just trauma compounding on the situation.
The book and movie set up this parallel that she doesn't want to leave like her mother left. She doesn't want to run, and she doesn't want to live afraid. And so it's setting up that her choices have narrowed to this one option. You're right. I don't know what I would recommend her to do. It's a tough situation that people are put in, and I think that's why the book is saying, what else could she have done, and trying to say this is justified almost, because she had no other option.
In the book, she does go to the Black community, though, mm-hmm. to Jumpin's home. And so I think for Hollywood's sake, that whole relationship there was really pared down to make us feel like she didn't have another option. But the example that was set in her life from a very early age was when the swamp got tough, you leave the swamp. Her mother walked out of the marsh. All of her siblings walked out of the marsh. And so her love of the marsh, I can believe it, sure. But the examples from a human perspective might be to go live with. Don't jump in. Because I don't think even back then that Chase would have walked into that community looking for her. So I do think there was another option.
That's something that I would think the book would have dealt with a little bit more. This is 1960s North Carolina, civil rights era nonsense and shenanigans going on. Would the African-American community have been a great place for her to go hang out?
They're uneasy about her being there, for sure. But for that time, while Chase is being aggressive, it was a safe place for her. So you were just asking if there were any other options. I just thought that was one that was suggested in the book, but not in the movie. It is tough, but I think it's given in such a way that I didn't hesitate. I made my daughters read the book first because I felt like the boyfriend grooming the sexual encounters was better done in the book, because we get an interiority from Kaya that we only see in the movie. We get to hear her thoughts of what that first time, that first sexual encounter was like for her. Where in the movie, we get what I think is a poor camera angle and not very much from her. She immediately is okay and wants to give him a necklace. Where in the book, she's not. As a mother, I wanted them to read the book before they saw the movie. And then we could talk about it. The movie is done in a very tasteful way. I don't ever feel like it wasn't tasteful. But I think it was dealt with more in the book. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. It is actually one that you could talk to older teenage daughters about to watch for. Is he only there and he only tells you the things you want to hear because he wants to touch you? And in this case, how did that turn out? Do you recognize the warning signs in your dating, or be aware of that?
Or even to model something for your teenage boys who, having been one, are weird and awkward, and especially having read so much from the Me Too movement. Like the scene where Chase says, hey, can I carry your bag for you? She's like, no, I got it. He's like, no, no. And he takes it from her. In an earlier version of me, I might have done that, but not out of maliciousness the way Kate does, but just like, no, no, let me help. Even though I'm ignoring her stated preference that I not help this way, diminishing her as a person and an agent in this moment, I'm trying to be a nice guy and just trying to help out. So to use the contrast between Chase and Tate to help model positive masculine interactions with women for your teenage boys, I think would be useful as well. Because at least for me, you know Chase is going to be the bad guy because he ends up dead. We start the movie with his murder. But it wasn't obvious to me. They tried to play it such that for at least a little while, you weren't quite sure where he was going. Because you follow her discovery of the situation when you don't know he's engaged to the girl until they run into each other just on the street, and the lady's there. So, oh, it's nice to meet you. I'm his fiance. And then just this devastating moment. Can we just give props to, I think Daisy Edgar Jones did amazing as the main actress playing this part. It's just so wonderful playing Kaya. She's got a lot going on in her face. And even if I kind of agree with you, Jamie, about the way the quasi-sexual assault first time together thing was played, maybe wasn't filmed quite as good as it could have been. I think for the most part, Daisy Edgar Jones, well, for the whole movie, she was just doing stellar work and is, I think, a highlight of the whole film.
The casting was quite spot on from the book to the movie, actually. I think the movie, early on, we get the feeling that Chase is a little full of himself, but in the book, I didn't get that. I was like, oh, cute, there's going to be a love triangle. Until we start to see his more aggressive moves, and you're like, wait a second, that doesn't feel right. Yeah, I thought the casting all around was so good. I just wish I could have had more from people like Jumpin'.
I think that the movie is fairly tastefully done in terms of how they show these two relationships and the different scenes you get, because they have to show some of it. I do have two friends who had not read the book. One is a young single adult and one is a mom friend of mine, and they both left the movie early and couldn't finish it. It was so intense. One of them is very sensitive to things related to sexual assault. And so I do think that there needs to be a little bit of warning if you don't know what you're getting into. Not only do you have this model of Chase and what the warning signs or the different things that come on, I love the foil setup between how Tate treats Kaya and how Chase does, right? You see someone showing a lot of respect and saying, I care about you too much to put you in this situation, and who's genuinely interested in what she is. And then you see Chase shutting her down, her interest, like making fun of the things that are important to her. Like when she first finds the shell, she doesn't get that's what he did because she made it into the necklace for him that then becomes this very important part. But I just think like both of those are exemplary in different ways. And I think the contrast is also powerful. And on the movie screen, I think that you feel that difference. Like when she's there with Tate, like you feel it's more wholesome in a lot of ways. And then you get it with Chase and it just feels yucky a lot.
The difference between the two of them is Tate waits for her to invite him to her house. Yeah. Right. He's very like respectful and goes slow. She's leading. Whereas literally when Chase demands to be taken to her house, he is leading the way in and she's like following behind and like getting dragged behind. Right. He is the driving force in the relationship, forcing things to go faster than she is comfortable with. And like I could feel that so much more from the movie.
Yeah.
Chase at one point does say the right thing when he first tries to kiss her and tries to make a move on her. She's like, no. And he backs off. He says, oh, I'm sorry. From now on, you initiate and then I'll follow through. But then he doesn't. So he says the right thing. For a minute, you're like, oh, okay, good. He figured out the error of his ways. He's going to try a little bit more better, a little more respectful moving forward. But then he does not actually adhere to what he has said. And so it just shows you that the bad guys can sometimes even say the right things and act in the correct manner, but it doesn't stay. You got to look at their actions, not their words, at least in the case of this one character.
And in the movie, at least, isn't it like it's the same day where he does that and then he takes her to the tower and then he's, oh, take me to your house and forces his way. And it turns like that. And I feel like I don't have personal experience with abusive men, but I have heard stories and you get that pattern. This, oh, no, you have to come back. I need you. These sorts of things, this kind of pleading and begging and promising and then no actual follow through. Mm-hmm. And often the opposite.
I think it's also a good kind of instruction point to talk about where consent is a great minimum, but it's not quite right because
it's a floor, not a ceiling.
She consents a couple times with Chase. There are some where she definitely isn't consenting. Even when she says, yes, you can kiss me. Because he's not really considering her as a human being. He's just waiting because he's been told he has to wait. He's not waiting because he wants her to also feel the relationship in the same way that he does. He doesn't care about what she feels at all. And that's apparent by the way he barges into her house. Because that's not something he's promised to not do. So he's just going to do whatever he feels like.
I was hoping that we could get Jamie and Liz to talk about the whole breaking the cycle of violence and lack of education thing, because you two like went at it in the show notes. I think that's great. There's a good conversation to be had there.
Where do you want us to start?
Well, I'm fascinating to think about people who do get out of this cycle, because often people who have tough childhoods have parents who don't take care of them or who abuse them in the way that Kaya's family did.
end up getting into those kind of relationships and families and perpetuating that cycle, right? It's something that happens to you, and so you do it to other people, and it happens over and over. That is not the story for Kaya. And in the book, it goes into more like her mother was not in this kind of cycle either. And so maybe that's why it isn't quite like a repetitive cycle. Her mother was more educated, and she kind of marries down, and her dad, the father, convinces her to, like, oh, it's going to be fine. We're going to do this thing. We're going to live out in the swamp by ourselves. And then it kind of moves downwards from there. Oh. But I find it, there's just a couple things that I find interesting about it. Like, in the book, spends a lot more time avoiding the foster care people, avoiding the social work system. It's brought up in the movie, like, when she's an adult, basically. Oh, a woman shouldn't be living on her own because we need to protect her virtue, which is kind of a different thing. In the book, it's more about, like, she needs an education and she needs parents to take care of her and that kind of thing.
I think one thing, in I think Carl's referring to it in our notes, is when you said that she had broken this cycle. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, she murdered. So I don't really see the cycle ending.
True.
And she got herself out of her situation, which she didn't. Had Tate not been there to teach her how to read, to give her the chance to make money, to buy the land, she was really dependent upon outside influences, which I think is a good talking point, that we need to talk about these things more so that people are educated about resources that are out there, things that can be done, looking for people who might need resources, and to say something like Tate does. Like, that to me is what I think breaks the pattern of violence and the lack of education and other things that lead in our world to things like drug abuse and crime and things like that. First, we need to start with just talking about it, even with young children. Yeah. If something is, we think something is going on.
I also liked the scene with Jumpin's wife, Mabel, where she says, I don't remember the Bible saying anything about being careful who we help. I think that's a really good attitude that she has, that they could get in trouble for getting involved in white people business, but she cares more about what God thinks about what she's doing. Definitely in the movie, it portrays them as they're the only truly Christian people in this town.
And Tate is the moral choice for a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. I think I really enjoyed / was annoyed by Tate finding out at the end. If this was to be a loving and caring relationship that she has now entered into, having never seen it modeled, she never shared that with him, that it was something that she didn't feel like she could tell him. And I would rather have not found out through Tate, so that I could have believed that this relationship was something that was healing for her, rather than something else she still needed to hide something from.
The marriage was not honest in some ways. And so maybe in some ways she lived a good life. She published all her books. She had a good time with Tate, kind of reconciled with her older brother, at least the one, but didn't really in the end fully break away from some of the things that she had started with. And that is a tragedy of this, even if we can think, given her options as a outcast woman in the 60s, very limited, narrow range of options, that doesn't seem like anybody of the four of us is really okay with what she did, even if it seems at least passably understandable to each of us. I did like your point also, Jamie, about how the movie could help all of us try to, in our own spheres of influence, look around and be a Tate to somebody, to be the person who helps people in their different circumstances, to lift up, whether it's someone that you know at church or through your school, your programs, whatever the situation you have, someone you minister to maybe. And I take your point very seriously that maybe in the 60s in North Carolina's marshlands weren't a lot of options for someone like Kaya to get a leg up, but Tate was that for her, and we should look around and see what we can do to help people in our areas to do that same thing, to be a Tate to people who need it.
I also think of that scene when Tate is coming to warn her about Chase. She starts throwing rocks at him because it's the first time he's come back in like 5 years, and yes, he broke her heart, but he doesn't get driven off by that. Like, he cares about her more than he cares about how she feels about him. Oftentimes, people who go through these kind of hard circumstances can be tough people to be friends with, can be tough people to be in a relationship with, and not giving up and not turning away and giving up on them is important. It can be hard to deal with those people, but I think it's important and it can be healing for both the people in that situation.
I think it was quite well done, actually, in the movie, his humility that I'm sorry that I hurt you. And that's, I think, when we've been injured by someone, that's what we're looking for, is that humility and that I'm sorry I did that, I was wrong. And to see that modeled in such a beautiful way, and to see actually they're really good acting back and forth, it was just beautiful. I agree. That was just a beautiful part of the movie.
We'll move on at this point to our rating segment. We give each film that we discuss three different ratings. The first rating is for content, so clean versus objectionable material. We rate on a scale of celestial, terrestrial, telestial, or outer darkness. Shelby, you want to go first on this one because you were talking about how some of your friends felt about it.
Sure. I'm not very good at rating things. I would probably put it in a telestial just in terms of I feel like people do need a warning note to know what's coming, especially if they haven't read the book first. So
yeah,
that's where I'll go with that.
Carl, what are you thinking?
So I think telestial as well. The thing that I found most shocking is I am used to sex scenes in PG-13 being like a shirt comes off or something. You see the girl's bra, maybe the guy's shirt's off and then fades to black, right? This movie does a lot more than that. And they have to because of some of the character development that sort of happens right after some of these moments of intimacy with each other. But I found it a little more explicit than I was expecting in a PG-13 movie because of that. And I don't know, in the 80s and 90s when I was growing up, this probably that the sex scenes might have made it rated R, but we don't care about that stuff as much anymore. So it's PG-13. And that surprised me a little bit. But aside from that, there is some heaviness to this movie. But as far as actual objectionable content, those are really the only things that are there, but they were explicit enough to me that I would knock it down to telestial.
Jamie, what are your thoughts?
I've never done this rating system before, so maybe I should hear your thoughts first, Liz.
Okay, I can go first. I agree. I feel kind of bad because it's not like a really explicit movie, except for that it is dealing frankly with sexual relationships and the consequences of it. And it does it as cleanly as it can while being frank about it. I don't think it's sensationalized in any way. But yes, if I were showing this to my teenagers as a parent, I would want to know about those scenes and have seen it beforehand and know my children before I show it to them. There are definitely people who would feel uncomfortable with not just the amount of skin that's shown, but like actual acts that are shown on screen. I'm not going to be any more explicit. Sorry.
That makes it sound more explicit than it is.
You know what's going on, even if you can't see what's going on. So I will put it that way. Jamie, do you want to weigh in?
So for me, I found it probably walking the gray line between telestial and outer darkness, only because I have so many teenage daughters and I had read the book and seen the movie before I made them read the book so they could see the movie because they wanted to see it. And for that reason alone, I had to preface what they were going to be reading, which I don't like to have to do. I want to trust the material. So if someone listening to this podcast said, this mother of four daughters said this was okay, I think I need to step into outer darkness and say, maybe your daughter has never experienced this, or maybe she's been close to experiencing this, and you need to talk to her about it before she reads it in fiction and sees how it's dealt with. I wouldn't want her backing over someone in the high school parking lot because she thought revenge was the way to deal with these things. So that's where I step gingerly across from telestial to maybe outer darkness, even though the movie is just beautiful. But just for that one thing, I would want people to know you need to be warned, basically.
How about we do this then? Let's call your rating telestial, but with a trigger warning.
Oh, for sure.
Oh.
I would want to experience it before my children, is what I'm saying. I would want to have read this and prepared myself to then turn around and talk to my daughters about it, which is why I would say that.
I think most literally parental guidance is suggested. Like, please
there you go.
See it before showing your children. but it is talking about important topics that are hard to cover.
It does it in a pretty talkable way, though. I mean, I think it portrays it in, if they're ready for it, we can talk about it.
It's an important topic, and so I'm giving it a telestial rating. It's not like a bad thing, but it is a maturity thing and things that you can handle. Our next rating is for artistic merit, which is for a skillful use of craft. 1 to 5 popcorn balls is our rating on this one. I think this movie gets at least 4 popcorn balls from me. I really enjoyed it. Like we said, the marsh is beautiful. Something that my non-visual brain didn't get from the book. And I felt like Daisy Edgar Jones did a really good job acting this character who doesn't talk a lot, which makes it hard to act. Like, she is quiet and reserved and not around a lot of other people. So she gets across a lot without a lot of words. So I'm going to give it 4 popcorn balls. Carl, what do you think?
I'd give it 4 popcorn balls as well. I've expressed a little bit of my dismay that it seemed like some of the sort of plot lines weren't quite as developed as they could have been. I think that's just a function of the runtime. You got to do what you got to do in a movie, but I don't know. I felt like it could have used 10 or 15 minutes maybe, and it would have been good. I got to say, though, I did watch it on and off as my kids were doing things and I had to stop and pause it at different places. So maybe my view of the pacing of the entire movie as a whole is skewed by the fact that stay-at-home parent of kids right now. So what do you do? But anyway, I'd give it 4 popcorn balls.
Jamie, what's your thoughts on artistic merit?
Are we talking about the movie or are we talking about the book?
You can do both if you want.
Okay. Well, good. I'll start with the book because I read it first back in 2019, I think, the year after it came out. I would give the artistic merit in the book probably 4 popcorn balls plus half of my husband's 5th. I would reach over and take part of his because I loved how it was paced and I loved the tension and I loved, for a first novel from an author, that is just gorgeous, straight up gorgeous. Danding, I have merit, so I would give him half of that 5th popcorn ball back. Like, he could have that part back. So 4.5 for the book. And then for the movie, this is really hard because you're saying artistic merit, which I take as the visual thing that I was presented with, just a smorgasbord. The music, the sound, the pause, the pacing, the things that they decided to take from the book to create a movie that does the same thing as the book is just so well done. Even though there's things, like Carl said, that we wish we would have had more of. Give it another 30 minutes and we could have had a more complex trial or more from Mabel and Jumpin'. But visually, I would give it all 5. Maybe even with a little like caramel on top, like caramel popcorn balls, because I could sit and just literally absorb that. But I'm a visual person, of course, all day long. For the acting, I would still give it 4.5. Popcorn balls, I would. And for the actual depth and dive into its honoring the book, I'd probably give it 3 popcorn balls. So how the adaptation part of it, because I'm a big adaptation junkie. So
love it. Very
there, that's where I stand. If I can give that many popcorn balls under one question, there it is.
I love it. I love it. Nuance is great. Shelby, what do you think?
I think I'm going to say 4 popcorn balls for artistic merit. I think so much of it is very beautiful. As a standalone movie by itself, it does so many things really well. And so yeah, we'll go with 4.
We don't get a lot of standalone movies anymore. It feels refreshing to not have to watch anything before you watch the movie. Except for read the book, obviously. You should read the book first or you're a horrible person. That's mostly a joke.
I beg your pardon.
And then our last rating is Gospel Connections and Moral Edifying Messages. And we do 1 to 5 apricot.
I would give it, well, that's a good question for this one. Because it certainly, I think, has some weighty moral messages and things that it makes you think about and contemplate about how we treat outsiders, about the proper way to do courtship, the long-term effects of abuse on a family and on children, and the proper way to respond to other people's shenanigans that negatively impact you. And that's a really simple way of glossing over sexual assault. So I don't know that I would say that this movie was morally edifying, because at the end, she killed this guy and she got away with it. And people were generally jerks to her, except for Tate. And so I don't know that I'd call it morally edifying, but it does bring up some good questions that would be worth exploring a little bit. I think overall, though, I'm going to have to give this one a 2. Raises some good questions, but I do not think I like the answers that this movie provides. Good questions, bad answers. I'm going to give it 2 apricots.
I kind of feel you there, Carl. It's difficult with this rating to differentiate between whether we're talking about is the movie itself morally edifying or is it bringing up good discussion. I think we've had a lot of good discussions, and there's definitely... it's a good piece of media to use if you're talking about questions of dating and sexual violence with teenagers or young adults, or even in your own past or friends. And this is a good way to bring up that conversation. But on the other hand, the movie itself does not explicitly have any kind of Christian perspective on it. There's not a forgiveness and repentance message. It is pretty explicitly Darwinist, like survival of the fittest. What you need to do to survive, you do. And so she does that. And that is pretty explicitly a not moral message from our perspective. Feel comfortable with your 2 apricots. I'll stick there. Shelby or Jamie, which one of you wants to jump in?
I also agree with the 2 apricots. I think, like Carl said, lots of questions, maybe not answers that we like. I do like the things that it brings up. I have a lot of hesitations about how things are resolved and how they sit. I do think that some really interesting questions, but I don't think it goes in the actual morally edifying direction. I think we can pull things out and we can talk about them and look at them and discuss them within the context of gospel or eternal truth or things like that. But in and of itself, I don't think it does a lot in that direction. 2 as well. Apricots.
All right, Jamie, you want to bring us home? And you're allowed to disagree.
Maybe it's not that I disagree with the 2. Maybe it's just that I disagree that I found the apricots juicy and satisfying, and more that I found the apricots dried and in some trail mix that I wasn't expecting. So maybe in that way, I have 3 apricots, right? And I have 3 of these salty little booger-looking things in my hand, and I'm like, what do I do with this? And that's what I felt like the movie was. Like, what do I do with this thing that, or this book? What do I do with this thing, and how am I going to stomach this, or how am I going to give this? Is like, this is a thing that we should be eating to my children. And so I think I would actually go with 3, just for the opportunity, and they have to be coming from trail mix and be salty and dry and kind of boogery. Not 3 juicy off the tree, okay? Things that would I walk by and go, oh gosh, that's gorgeous. I need to buy that. Trail mix has got apricot in it. No. But would I appreciate it when I found it? Yes. Because any opportunity to talk to my children, even if the book itself didn't give me the answer that I would give my children in that contrast, I can still bear my testimony of what I know to be true. And that I find edifying is that moment. So if I even hit that remotely into the park of what you guys do with these ratings, that's what I get.
No, I love it. I love you've got your creative writerness all over our rating system.
I do. Yes. Yeah.
There you go. Well, as always, you can find my writing and book reviews on lizbusby.com.
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Cranny.
Shelby, where can people find you?
I share my art on social media at Shelby Thane Art if you want to check it out.
She's got some really gorgeous watercolor art, you guys. You should check out her art, and we'll have links to her show notes. But Jamie, you're not online anywhere, right?
I'm not. I am so reclusive. I don't know, introverted. I'm just busy. I have 5 children, and I'm enjoying being a mother and an MFA student and teaching, and I am just enjoying it all. That I don't have time for social media anymore. I used to, and I just don't.
Do not apologize for not being on social media. You're fine.
All right. Thank you for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with a friend who enjoys movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe to the podcast on the platform of your choice and leave us a rating or review. We also love getting feedback from our listeners, so drop us a line on social media or through our website. Shout out to listener Rachel, who sent us a message this week that totally made my day. we love to hear from you. So if this episode sparked something for you, please send us a message. Carl, can you tell us what we'll be discussing in our next episode?
All right. So next time we're going to be discussing Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. Chris Pine and Michelle Rodriguez star in this fantasy jaunt through the realms of Faerun, playing the leaders of a team of misfits seeking to stop the item that they stole from falling into the wrong hands. Looks like a fun-filled time that doesn't take itself too seriously. I'm going to go watch the movie tomorrow night, and the day after we'll be introducing five people from my ward to the actual game of Dungeons & Dragons. So it's going to be a D&D weekend for me. I've been playing for 15 years, and I have hopes that this movie is as fun as this weird little hobby of mine has proven to be. So get ready for that conversation next time.
All right. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.